trees. Thank you for riding with MTA New York City Transit.
New York, my hometown. I left for London when I was 3, but still think of myself as a native New Yorker. To my mind, nothing embodies this mighty city better than the New Yorker magazine. A stack of back issues lingers on my coffee table from one year to the next. A weekly digest of essays, political comment, world news, fiction, poetry, listings, reviews, and, like a lick of mustard in a hot pastrami sandwich, it's one-line cartoons.
Who are you going to see in the New Yorker?
David Remnick.
There you go, ladies. Passports.
The New Yorker's illustrious past and reputation for editorial integrity give the magazine a mystique that makes most writers long to be published in it. When its editor agreed to let me loose inside the New Yorker's offices at No. 4 Times Square, I felt like Dorothy at the gates of the Emerald City.
The magazine is meant to be utterly unexpected, that you could get it on a given week, and there could be a piece on Guantanamo as the lead of the magazine at the center of it, or there could be a big piece about pigeon racers or shopping in some strange part of the world.
David Remnick, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, was a staff writer before he became editor in 1998. There have only been 4 other editors in the magazine's 80-year history, but under David Remnick's direction, the magazine's circulation has grown by 20% to more than 1 million.
Truly, the magazine that we publish week to week is the magazine that I want to read. That's the idea of the magazine, that it's a human thing. It's not done by committee or by survey. It's a small collection of people, what they're passionate about, and then we hope you like it. It's not like McDonald's or Burger King. It's like one of those small restaurants that you're lucky enough to come upon once in a while where mom and pop and the uncle and the crazy grandmother are in the back and they're producing what we think you should eat that day. And we don't necessarily give you a whole lot of choice about it, but it turns out over time to be a terrific, memorable place.
The New Yorker prides itself on its literary tradition, but David believes that 99% of readers turn first to the cartoons.
2.5 hours.
Yeah. 2.5 hours? Wow. It would take me 2.5 weeks.
Well, once he finishes the drawing, he puts all these lines on.
Once a week, a herd of cartoonists gather outside the office of Bob Mankoff, the New Yorker's cartoon editor. One by one, they're called in to pitch their ideas.
All right, Jack, you come in.
I've been here since 8 a.m. waiting for this.
How are you?
I'm good.
Yeah. First in is Jack Ziegler, who's contributed over 1,000 cartoons to The New Yorker. He's clutching a selection of his latest drawings.
This is funny. Angry woman. Hey, when was the last time you pined for me? This could almost be a sitcom with this slovenly, slobby male guy down in his den. Oh, he's got these... What are these girly pictures doing?
Well, this is a special den.
I can see his wife might be pissed.
this is his refrigerator over here where he keeps all his beer.
What's this over here?
This is part of a pool table.
Oh.
So he's never leaves this area.
Yeah, right.
But his room is down in the basement, you can see, because she has to come whenever she talks to him.
Where does an idea for a cartoon like that come from?
Just being around angry women for most of your life.
The New Yorker more or less invented what's known as the gag cartoon, and it's been a feature of the magazine since its earliest days. Bob has an intriguing view on the role that it plays.
It's a nuanced enterprise where it really involves more than making people laugh. It also involves making people think. And I personally don't think the comic mode of thinking is inferior to the rational mode. I think it's an intuitive mode that is an important part of a democracy, important part of a populace that actually has to make decisions but can't possibly have the information necessary to make those decisions. But, you know, what humor often does is says, this thing smells funny. And that's actually how we make the decisions in a democracy. We, you know, how much can you actually know about Iraq? How much can you actually know about the Federal Reserve System? You judge people and their motives in an intuitive way. And I think that the cartoons in general are a counterweight to this idea that rationally we can figure things out. And the humor is always saying that. It's always saying that there are limits to what you can figure out.
Do you feel any sense of hurt about the cartoons that have been rejected this morning?
No, not at all. I mean, rejection is a big part of the deal.
And now you can take it to another magazine and sell it there?
I'm free to do that. Just do Reader's Digest.
The New Yorker was conceived over a poker game at the Algonquin Hotel on West 44th Street and launched in 1925. Harold Ross, a Runyon-esque Westerner with gap teeth and hedgehog hair, its founder and editor until his death in 1951, wanted to create a magazine that was satirical and witty, a sophisticated reflection of metropolitan life in the Jazz Age.
Welcome everyone to the Algonquin Hotel. My name is Kevin Fitzpatrick. I'm the president and founder of the Dorothy Parker Society. You're in the roundtable room.
On the ground floor of the hotel, there's a painting of Ross and Dorothy Parker, queen of Manhattan's literary elite, along with other members of the Algonquin Round Table, also known as the Vicious Circle. Together, they helped make The New Yorker one of the most influential magazines in America.
For about 10 years, this group of writers, editors, artists, actors would come here for lunch for a couple of hours, and they would trade wits and, you know, jokes and stories and things. But a lot of them were newspaper columnists, so the next day, whatever they said was going to be in that morning or afternoon's paper. So that's what really built up their legend. And so when The New Yorker was going to be started, Harold Ross, the founder, turned to his friends and said, you know, I'm going to get this magazine going. Would you guys like to contribute to it? And so that's why it all started right here.
A.J. Liebling wrote for The New Yorker from the mid-30s to the 1960s. He often returned to his pet themes, boxing, horse racing, and gourmet food, and brought home the realities of the Second World War to readers with his reports from Europe. Liebling likened his boss, Harold Ross, to an impresario who put on a weekly variety bill of the printed word and the graphic gag. After Ross died, Liebling wrote,
Ross had some raffish friends I envied him, and some stuffed shirt friends I wouldn't be seen dead with. He was equally proud and I think equally fond of all of them. He liked anybody who had a lot of money or a good story to tell. And since these are minerals seldom found in conjunction, he prospected around. The New Yorker he made reflected this idiosyncrasy, but not what the kids now call dichotomy.
Many outstanding writers have written for The New Yorker. Isaac Bashevis Singer, Vladimir Nabokov, Susan Sontag, Nicole Krauss. It's a potent blend of fact and fiction. Extracts of Truman Capote's In Cold Blood were first published in the magazine in 1965. Annie Proulx's short story Brokeback Mountain appeared in 1997. Both were feted at this year's Oscars.
In 1963, when he met Jack Twist, Ennis was engaged to Alma Beers. Both Jack and Ennis claimed to be saving money for a small spread. In Ennis's case, that meant a tobacco can with two $5 bills inside. That spring, hungry for any job, each had signed up with farm and ranch employment. They came together on paper as herder and camp tender for the same sheep operation north of Signal. The summer range lay above the tree line on Forest Service land on Brokeback Mountain. It would be Jack Twist's second summer on the mountain, Ennis's first. Neither of them was 20.
Bill Buford was fiction editor at the magazine when Annie Proulx's story was published.
When she submitted the story, she submitted it to us and Harper's. And she wanted it to be published by Harper's, and we had to persuade her agent that she should be published by The New Yorker. And I had to respond with enough enthusiasm to persuade Annie Proulx that it should appear in The New Yorker. And then I made her rewrite it. She writes a very dense, arcane, localized, in this case, cowboy prose. That was a very exciting story for us. It was long. It had a great effect. Everyone read it. Everyone talked about it. It got prizes. The film rights immediately got snapped up. The week it appeared.
What makes Brokeback Mountain such a perfect short story for The New Yorker?
Mainly it just worked. A great piece of fiction is a rare, rare thing. And in Annie's story, we got that great piece of fiction. Now, what makes it different from other stories in part is that it was just so ambitious. And it's really a novel compressed into a story. And it has the density of a novel. And it's got the narrative arc of a novel. And it puts you in a place in a way that most novels more than stories succeed in doing. It's just a great literary achievement.
And is it only the first? It's not only the first time.
Well,
it's
in other words, he makes, he does, but it's like from the second.
Deborah Treisman, the current fiction editor, who also edits some of the review sections, is going through Nancy Franklin's review of a new TV show. Deborah has helped launch the careers of several new writers. She explains why there's no such thing as a typical New Yorker short story.
When you think about the people we publish, you think about Haruki Murakami, you think about George Saunders, Alice Munro, you know, Richard Ford. None of these people would go in the same category. None of them have anything in common in terms of style or even in terms of ambition and what they're trying to do in a story. So there's no category that I can see. What we look for, it's difficult to define, but I look at it in terms of impact and in terms of a story succeeding on its own terms, so that if a story is trying to be very linguistically playful, it has to do that. It has to do that well. If it's trying to be very classical and moving, it has to do that well. So it can't sort of fail at what it's aiming to do. But if it succeeds, it doesn't really matter to me which genre or what its particular ambition is, so long as it has an impact.
Jonathan.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
I'm on the Upper East Side with Jonathan Franzen, whose non-fiction work for The New Yorker sustained him, as he puts it, financially and morally, while he was writing his best-selling novel, The Corrections.
I actually tried for many years to get fiction into The New Yorker. So after about 2 years of every 3 week rejections for my really bad stories, I looked around and decided to find other work. But later, when I really was hurting for money, it occurred to me that maybe I should try to work as a journalist. So I pitched an idea to The New Yorker and to a couple of other magazines. But The New Yorker was the one that actually listened seriously and gave me this enormous contract and this enormous number of words to go and write about the Chicago Post Office. I'd never done journalism before. I had precisely no experience. All I had was two novels. And they were willing to look at the novels and to see the potential in somebody who walked in off the street. So I feel as if my life as a writer was saved in substantial part by that association with the magazine, because it had this huge stature in my mind. It's certainly synonymous with literary America. So I feel this tremendous sense of gratitude to them.
When you're writing for the magazine, how much interference is there in the writing?
Writing for The New Yorker has changed my language. I'll give you an example of the way The New Yorker has changed my writing. Historically, the magazine has been in bitter combat with what is called indirection. Indirection is introducing information as if it's already known to the reader, so that we meet a composer and his long brown hair is pulled back in a ponytail. That's a no-no at The New Yorker. You have to say, he has long brown hair, and it is pulled back in a ponytail. And here's why, because logically you look at the sentence, his long brown hair was pulled back in the ponytail, what, and his red hair and his gray hair were still hanging down in his face? You know, it doesn't make any sense. His long brown hair, you have to say he has long brown hair before you're allowed to say his long brown hair. So what seems like a kind of fussy, technical, editorial edict is in fact all about clarity of thought.
At The New Yorker, a linguistic ploy known as elegant variation, the unnecessary use of synonyms to mean a single thing, is also frowned on. And you never start a metaphor that you don't complete. There is rigorous attention to detail, but everyone at the magazine acknowledges this is not intended to squash personal style.
Of all the myths about The New Yorker, the most misleading is that there is a house style and that it is enforced. Well, no such thing exists. I think we have shared beliefs, but that's a different thing than a house style, a belief that there's always a simpler way to say it, a belief above all in wit and in humor, that there's very, very few subjects that shouldn't be written about with a sense of humor in the deepest sense, a sense of common sense, really, sort of set dancing on the page.
Adam Gopnik has been at The New Yorker for 20 years. When he arrived, William Shawn was the editor. Then came Robert Gottlieb. For some years, there had been a feeling that the magazine was stagnating. In 1992, the flamboyant British-born Tina Brown was brought in to revamp it. In a blaze of controversy, she introduced some radical changes. It became more risque. Many new people were hired, including the first staff photographer. but twice as many old hands were fired. Adam thrived under the new regime.
When Tina Brown arrived here, the magazine, though I think it had always included wonderful writing, had somewhat slipped away from its original journalistic mission, which is no more than just regular commentary on the passing scene. And Tina refocused the magazine on that mission. So we ended up writing, all of us did, to some degree, more journalistic work than we'd done before. The New Yorker is at heart a curious alchemy of writing and journalism, of literature and reporting. Now, having said that, Tina was hugely receptive to writing for writing's sake. And in fact, I went off to Paris for 5 years, and I ended up writing out of the desire of my own heart, not journalistic things for the most part, though I did some, but comic, sentimental essays about the nature of family life and the nature of expatriation and difference, cultural difference, and child rearing and so on. And Tina was delighted to publish those.
I'm Hendrik Hertzberg. I'm a senior editor here. I'm a political writer, essentially. People call me Rick.
Rick Hertzberg's comment is the first item in the magazine's Talk of the Town section.
So I have to say that this is the most chaotic office I've been into yet. There's clothing, there are bags, there's takeout dishes in the waste paper bag, there are books tumbling all over the place, magazines.
This is an uninflated air mattress that I use when I do an all-nighter here and stay overnight. I grab naps on that.
Why would you sometimes have to do sleepovers here?
I've always been, ever since I was in college, I've had bad work habits, and they've involved basically an all-nighter for every piece of prose I've ever written. And it's now incurable. And even though I'm in my 60s, I can't stop working like an undergraduate.
Rick's wife is also his editor, so at least they see each other during the day. I wanted to know what he, as chief political commentator, thought was the tone of the magazine.
It's an urbane voice. It's a voice that doesn't talk down to readers. What we're offering is thinking and perspective and reflection. The main thing is to take what readers have been absorbing anyway through the newspapers and TV and other magazines they read and try to interpret it and make some sense out of it. But the newspaper industry is in deep trouble, and the number of people who are employed to report, you know, to spend their days gathering facts is rapidly declining. And the number of people who are parasites on that process, like me, who just sit around and we make use of these sort of public utilities. You know, you turn the tap on of the New York Times or the Washington Post and out comes all this information. And then, you know, you just sift through it as you like. But we take that tap for granted. And there's less and less coming out of it. The danger is we're going to end up with a world of commentators all commenting on the same few shards of inaccurate information. That's the nightmare.
I'm beginning to understand that what gives the New Yorker its flavor is that contributors are given scope for their individuality to shine through. Adam Gopnik again.
The only rule that I make in my own heart is that anything I write about, and I think most people here feel that way, has to be something that I am genuinely and obsessively interested in. If I'm not already talking about it, then I don't really want to write about it. Because what I think the readers want is that authenticity of engagement. They want a feeling that this isn't an exhausted hack running on one more time about something that he's been given to do or she's been given to do and is doing a set number of pirouettes on the subject and then is signing off. But instead, that this is something that the writer really genuinely cares about.
Look, right here, you have a cover by Mariscal, who's a Spanish artist. We're talking about February 1994. Right next to it, you have a cover by Robert Crumb.
With its Art Deco title font, the New Yorker's distinctive covers, often a seasonal drawing of Manhattan or an ironic illustration of current events, evoke an earlier era, albeit with a modern subversive twist. On the wall outside the office of the art editor, Françoise Mouly, is a vibrant display of all the covers since she arrived 13 years ago. One, from 2001, has huge personal significance for Françoise and her husband, Art Spiegelman, who was a staff artist at The New Yorker for a number of years.
On September 11th, I was actually with Art, and we were on our way to vote because it was a Democratic primary. And we saw an airplane flying overhead go crash into the first tower. And then almost immediately, the main thing I wanted to do was to get my daughter out because she went to high school at that time, right there at the foot of the towers. And I just went into a kind of mental focus, which is I want my daughter, I want my daughter, I want my daughter out. So I run, I drag the art along, I run to my daughter's school, and got there so hysterical that they actually let me in.
At 10:05, the South Tower collapsed while Francoise and Art were searching for their daughter. Eventually, they found her and fled north. At 10:29, the second tower crumbled right behind them. Meanwhile, David Remnick was leaving urgent messages for Francoise. Their next issue would need a special cover.
There was a sense of, like, you know, nothing could capture the magnitude of what had happened. Art was working on an image of a shroud over the World Trade Center towers. He took it a step further and started thinking, well, black on black. So we worked this out just in the nick of time. And I knew this was the right thing. You know, I felt reinvigorated in, like, my mission in life. I tend to have a missionary zeal about artists and the power of drawings. I just think, like, in, you know, in the beginning of the 21st century, and you still have just like some lone man or woman with a pen, and then that produces, you know, something that can be so powerful. I find it magical.
The cover that appeared on the newsstands the following Monday, Two Black Towers Against a Dark Night, has become an iconic image for 9/11.
I don't want to be narcissistic about it. It's not just that the New Yorker changed after 9/11. Everything changed after 9/11.
Editor David Remnick.
It wasn't just that event. It was the need to be far more aware of the world. And so the amount of resources we were devoting to covering anything ranging from Middle Eastern politics to South Asia to abuse of human rights, here and abroad, the White House. It became, the political volume of the magazine certainly increased after 9/11.
You took a lot of flack for initially appearing to support America's invasion of Iraq.
I was very critical of the administration's pseudo-debate about the war. On the other hand, I was of the opinion that if WMD it was really a threat, then we needed to do something about this. But clearly, the great failure of American journalism, the New Yorker included, was the failure ahead of time to make sense of the WMD picture and how intelligence was being used, not used, piped, or stovepiped, as it was called, through the ranks.
In the last few years, the New Yorker has been making waves with hard news stories like Seymour Hersh's investigation into American soldiers using torture at Abu Ghraib. And, more recently, his revelations about the Bush administration's plans to attack Iran's nuclear sites. These are the articles that give the magazine's fact-checkers their worst headaches. Peter Canby is head of the fact-checking department.
One of our more complicated writers to work with is Seymour Hersh, who writes investigative pieces about Washington, which are based largely on blind sources. We speak with his sources, but we also, because the Pentagon, for example, the Defense Department, won't typically speak to Cy Hersh, and nor will the White House. We are often the ones who first contact them to tell them that we have a story, and then we try to negotiate a way to check the details of that story. And it gets to be quite a complicated dance.
Uh-huh. Yeah, what I just wanted to do was run through stuff and sort of talk about some little things that I thought we should change and then also ask you some questions, some stuff I haven't...
16 bright-eyed fact-checkers, fluent in 7 different languages, with special interests that range from national security to 16th-century horticultural manuals, unravel every sentence of every article and meticulously test them for accuracy. Even cartoons and memoirs, like Jonathan Franzen's essay on birdwatching, a personal reflection about birds, global warming, and his divorce, which appeared in The New Yorker last year.
For a long time, back in the 80s, my wife and I lived on our own little planet. We spent thrilling, superhuman amounts of time by ourselves. In our first two apartments in Boston, we were so absorbed in each other that we got along with exactly one good friend. And when we finally moved to Queens, the friend moved to Manhattan, thereby sparing us the need to find a different friend. Early in our marriage, when a former professor of mine asked me what the two of us were doing for a social life, I said we didn't have one. That's sweet for a year, he said, 2 years at most. His certainty offended me. It struck me as extremely condescending, and I never spoke to him again.
A lot of the checking had to do with the birds that he was describing. There were one or two places where he had forgotten which bird it was, and we discovered that the bird he said he had seen in this place couldn't possibly have been there.
Jonathan Shannon had the unenviable task of being Franzen's fact-checker.
As far as the rest of it, the memoiristic part, you call up people who he's mentioning and try to find out if what he's saying about them is accurate. So he has a section in that piece where he discusses his ex-wife, and I had to give her a call on the phone, and she was friendly but not cooperative and said that if I didn't mind, she didn't really want to talk to me. And I told her, well, you know, it's my job to listen to see if you have any objections to how we're depicting the story, and she said, no, that's fine.
Well, you know, as I'm looking through the dummy book, I'm looking for loose ends. I'm looking for kind of straggling pieces of yarn dangling from the sweater of this garment. Mistakes, repetitions, cartoons that seem like the same joke.
It's Friday afternoon, and David Remnick is having one more check of this week's issue. There's a feature on the president of Liberia, another about Impressionist painters' use of picture frames, and a review of Spike Lee's new movie, a classic New Yorker mix.
The formula for this magazine is very strange indeed. And maybe it's an odd recipe to conceive of being invented in the contemporary world. I'm just grateful that we have the recipe and the freedom to keep renewing it and not let it fall into the status of a museum.
The final word goes to the reader. On the last page of the magazine is the cartoon caption contest. Each week, there's a new drawing, and readers are invited to submit an appropriate caption. Back to Bob Mankoff for one of his favorites.
There's a boardroom, and everyone has a parrot on their shoulder, okay? And the boss is sort of looking like that, and one person is saying to the other, what? Well, that's what you have to come up with, you know? So one answer, and one of the finalists that we chose was, Dave, we've got to think of a better way to record our meetings.
So, if you want to be published in The New Yorker, all you need to do is close your eyes, tap your heels 3 times, and come up with a killer line.
Okay, another issue done, and on to next week.